This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Shall I start? Yes. This paper is about the phenomenon of the young modern woman in the 1920s, and it's a paper that's evolved extraordinarily slowly out of a long, quite a long-standing interest, as I'll explain. But it really became much more vivid in my mind when I had the opportunity to organize a short season at the National Film Theatre in London of films that they called flapper films. These were just, they were Hollywood films of the mid to late 1920s that were made really for a female audience, young female audience. And so seeing some of these films, even though I couldn't really catch up with them very much afterwards, was one of the ways in which, one of the influences, one of the points of departure for that ended up in this paper. And this paper is very much thoughts, you know, thoughts on the topic. And also, it's a way of trying to shift my own thoughts and my own engagement through the topic of the young modern woman in the 1920s, into thinking about the relationship between the cinematic text and its historical context. And any of you who've read my work will realize that for me, this question of the representation of gender has been primarily one of text. And I argued in the 1970s that Hollywood cinema of the studio system produced a film aesthetic that was essentially organized by a regime of desire, which was materialized in the pleasures of cinematic spectatorship, and one that was deeply imbricated with gendered power relations. Now, it was reading Miriam Hansen's work on Rudolph Valentino in the 1980s that first introduced me to the question of finding a historical context to spectatorship theory. And she argued that Rudolph Valentino's star persona was the object of the desiring female look. And she also argued that the audience for his movies was thus assumed by the film industry to be female. So this is the audience for Valentino movies, but also for other, what we might call matinee idol, male movie stars. So immediately, the Valentino case, and particularly Miriam Hansen's arguments, complicated my spectatorship argument, which wasn't necessarily to negate it, but it seemed to me that it demonstrated that the erotics of the cinematic look were not uniform across the history of Hollywood cinema, and I'd only really been thinking about Hollywood in the first instance. But on the other hand, while Hansen's argument complicates the gendered nature of spectatorship in the 1920s, it does confirm the importance of desire as a driving force affecting the language and aesthetics of this particular cinema. So the question that then comes up, obviously, is what were the conditions, social, economic, that produced a cinema spectatorship that could acknowledge the erotic female gaze? And this kind of question leads to the particular conditions of modernity and the particular phenomenon of the young modern woman, flapper, as she was known in the United States and Britain. In France, she was la garçonne, and in Germany, she produced girl culture, kind of the kind that we saw with the young women in Menschen am Sonntag. So in here, the woman would act as a kind of emblem of modernity and its culture. And to my mind, the implications of modernity and its culture were actually affecting many advanced urban conglomerates in not necessarily yet industrialized or semi-industrialized areas of the world. One could certainly think of Shanghai, Alexandria, Rio were places where the cinema was also beginning to emerge, but I'll come back to that a little bit later on, just in passing. So films directed at a female audience in the 1920s suggest a model that places the woman in the audience both as text and as context. And Miriam Hansen points out, the notion of ambivalence is crucial to a theory of female spectatorship, precisely because the cinema, while enforcing patriarchal hierarchies in its organization of the look, also offers women an institutional opportunity to violate the taboo on female scopophilia. The success of a figure like Valentino, himself overdetermined as subject and object of the look, urges us to insist upon the ambivalent constitution of scopic pleasure, its potential reversibility and reciprocity of roles. But the power of female box office was not responsible only for the matinee idol, but also for this minor genre, which I call flapper films. And these were films about young women, and they starred the new generation of so-called movie moderns, such as Colleen Moore, Clara Bow, Gloria Swanson, Joan Crawford, Louise Brooks, so on. And these films were made, starring the movie moderns, made for their counterparts in the audience. Unlike the passive femininity that gave rise to theories of a masculinized cinematic gaze in the 1970s feminist film theory, the flapper star could control the look of desire and drive the narrative, often rather flimsy narrative, forward. So rather than relaying the female spectator's look at the female star through a male protagonist and constructing the masculinized female spectator, the flapper film creates a shifting pattern of looks. Clarence Badger, reminiscing about directing It for Paramount in 1927, was struck by the way in which Clara Bow, its star, manipulated a series of looks when she first sees Antonio Marino. And he asked Clara what was going on. And this is the story he recounts that she said said this. And I'll show you the extract in a minute. Clara said, "Well, if you knew your onions, Mr. Badger, you'd know that the first expression was for the lovesick dames in the audience. That second expression was for the boys and their papas. And that third expression, well, Mr. Badger, just about the time that all the old women in the audience had become shocked and scandalized by the passionate part, they'd suddenly see the third expression and become absorbed in it and change their minds about me having naughty ideas and go home thinking how pure and innocent I was. And having got me mixed up personally with the character I'm playing, they'd come again when my next picture showed up." So can we just show this first clip? And it's Antonio Marino who's the matinee idol in this case. Oops. So that's Clara, who's very famous for her desiring look. But here we can see her relaying the female spectator's desire through her look at the male star's spectacle, and note the way that he doesn't see her. There's no reverse look. He's simply the object of hers and all the other shop girls' gaze. And then she constructs an imaginary exchange of erotic looks with the male spectator, substituting himself, as it were, for Alfredo Moreno, but then also manipulating the constraints of censorship, the old women, and marketing future box office on the other. So it seemed to me that this kind of triple look that Clara describes wittily confirms this intertwining of the language of sexuality and the language of cinema. But then this iconography leads outwards and away from the cinema itself to the social and economic conditions that created the flapper and the discourse of sexuality that was associated with her. Now, Janet Steiger, writing about the origins of the flapper, had made comments on the importance of the teens as a transitional period for the emergence of this young modern woman phenomenon, and she points out that the term flapper originated as early as 1910, that H.L. Mencken wrote about her in 1915, and that William Marion Reedy had in 1913 announced that it was 6 o'clock in America. And Steiger points out that these cultural trends need to be understood within the context of the economic. she says, in this transitional period into an industrialized, urban, multicultural, global, and consumer society, the struggle over what the new woman would mean was not just a question of gender debates. A new woman was necessary for the new order. Women were necessary for the heterosocialized labor market. Women were important in the expansion of consumption into the realm of pleasure and leisure. Thus, debates over the meaning of woman and her actions are also about constructing new social arrangements to correlate with changing economic conditions. And in an article on Cecil B. DeMille's sex comedies, Sumiko Higashi draws attention to the way in which the movie mogul Jesse Lasky understood the new market in the early 1920s. She says, Lasky advised DeMille and his scenarist, note that it's a woman, Jeannie McPherson, to write something typically American that would portray a girl in the sort of role that feminists in the country are now interested in. The kind of girl that dominates, who jumps in and does a man's work. And famous players Lasky, Paramount, were about to emerge in the forefront of the flapper genre during the 1920s. And so it seemed to me that Lasky's comments are indicative of the way that the film industry was responding to the expansion of the economy, the phenomenon of the rise of the new woman, and the question of the new order. So these quotations illustrate the importance of the economic factors behind this new woman, new order. The revolution in the culture, the discourse of femininity, emerges out of a special kind of economic expansion, the one that's called the Second Industrial Revolution, one that particularly affects young women who go out into new industries in large numbers. And during this period of economic boom, during the 1920s, the proportion of women in work in the overall United States population doubled. At the same time, the explosion of management in American capitalism led to an equal expansion of the role of the secretary, and the culture of consumerism that expanded obviously with the economic boom also created new opportunities of work for women. So you have leisure industries, department stores, fashion industry, the entertainment industries, the film industry itself all brought new employment opportunities. And the flapper films of the 1920s reflect these environments. And for instance, in the famous play Lasky movies, which are very often written by women and about working class heroines, they are seen very much in employment. And New York plays what you could think of as a starring role in these movies. They live in lodging houses, they live with girlfriends, and quite clearly they don't live with their families. But it always seems significant to me that the shop girls, the girls are working in the service industries, above all department stores, working but closely linked to the iconographies of consumption, as we saw Clara Bow just now. And it always seemed to me that quite striking that these working class girls in the screen are never shown in factories, in spite of the enormous expansion of female employment in manufacturing industries at the time. So these new incomes, with the help of expanding credit that we all associate with the boom period of the 1920s, fed back into a commodity boom, and clothes, cosmetics, bobbed hair, short skirts, high heels, lipstick powder, the familiar iconographical attributes of the young modern woman. So all of these fashion signs emphasize and construct a femininity as sexually connotative in appearance, but as a very new and different kind of image-making. Beauty products, for instance, were no longer the sign of the prostitute, but of modernity. I remember, Gwendolyn, you mentioned this shift the other day. So a cosmetics manufacturer such as Helena Rubinstein, who previously catered only to the film industry, could launch her products on the mass market. So the most important characteristic of this new market was that elegance was cheap, ready-made, to be bought off the peg, priced for working-class women. And a commentator at the time points out that Paris fashion and its exclusive connection with the elite and the aristocratic was being swept away. Quotation, "Fashions in this country are no longer ruled by a few leaders of society. They're determined by the purchases of several million women, each of whom buys a pleasing dress, puts it on immediately, wears it shabby, and buys another. The girl with the pay envelope sets the style for women who dressmake at home." And at the same time, just to go back to Janet Steiger's comment about the expansion of leisure and entertainment that went with the rise of the young modern working woman. During this period, leisure time had been transformed from the time of the leisured classes to the free time of the working classes, and in the process opened up an enormous new market potential for entertainment and leisure as a rising industry. And so in the 1920s, the new entertainment industries catered to a prosperous working class, and the young woman's insatiable demand for liberated but necessarily respectable fun. There's always this kind of fusion of respectability and fun. And just to mention one example, Coney Island features in so many of the 1920s movies, where it's transformed from a place of louche men looking for prostitutes in the early part of the century, looking gambling prostitutes, to a highly commercial mass entertainment park suitable for family outings and dating couples. And we see this iconographic visit to Coney Island in many movies of the time. King Vidor's The Crowd, when John and Mary go to Coney Island on their first date. One moment, just realized we've got another clip. And in Coney Island, the rides, especially the dark tunnel of love, offers the possibility and even actually legitimizes physical contact and courting. And in It, that we just saw a sequence from, Betty Lou, Clara Bow, manages to win a bet. I won't go into the details. And so her boss loses the bet and says to Clara, "What will I do as a forfeit?" And she says, "Let's go to the beach." And this visit to Coney Island, where Betty Lou takes Mr. Waltham, the owner of the department store, who we saw her looking at a moment ago, I see it as his first lesson in social mobility. I mean, this is the way in which the Cinderella stories of this period, in a sense, are in reverse, in that the prince, the department store owner, has to learn democratization of manners rather than the working girl learning to be a princess. And I think this is a very interesting phenomenon, and one can see it go also associated very much with the sexualization, the attraction of the young working girl, but also her insistence on respectability. And actually, if any of you know Zola's wonderful novel, Au Bonheur des Femmes, there's very much a very similar kind of tension between Denise's relationship with the owner of the department store. Anyway, this is just one example of Coney Island, and I wish I had a longer extract, but we don't have much time, and this is all I have on my clips tape. Social mixer. There's another one when they're going down a slide, when she sits in front of him, she turns around and says, "Hold me tight, Mr. Waltham." And you could see that's going to be a definitive moment in their turning point in their relationship. Now, just as a small bit of background, these movies addressed a self-conscious, young, female, working-class audience. But the film industry belonged, it's part of a popular culture, and I'm sure there are people here who know much more about this than I do, a popular culture that was also quite highly feminized. In 1928, of the 10 books on the bestseller list, 8 were by women. A third of Hollywood's screenwriters were women, who either created their own material or adapted existing stories, which were very much by women, very often by women writers or from women's magazine stories. Frances Marion, who was the most successful screenwriter of the time, man or woman, earned $3,000 a week, which was a considerable amount of money in the 1920s. And she had a close working relationship with Kate Corbally, who was head of script development at MGM. Earlier, Anita Loos wrote many screenplays for her friend Constance Talmadge. And people have been writing about and researching these. I think there's a book called kind of The Women's Circle, and also bringing in the question of kind of erotic relations between women as well as those of support. There was a sense of solidarity in female presence in the industry in these days, and one that I think failed to survive the 1929 crash or the coming of sound, which I'll come back to later on. And it's interesting that the only woman who managed to make it through as a director from this period, Dorothy Arzner, directed her first talkie with Clara Bow in her first talkie. But Clara Bow found that the talkies slowed down her speed You couldn't jump around in front of the microphone in the way that she'd been used to jumping around. We'll see her again in a minute. Now, just before moving on to another point, I want to sum up and just say Scott Fitzgerald, early in the decade, dedicated the 20s to flaming youth in a well-known cliché. In 1922, Colleen Moore bobbed her hair and launched the flapper image across the Hollywood screen. And Fitzgerald said, again, everybody knows this, "I was the spark that lit up flaming youth, and Colleen Moore was the torch." So out of and alongside the growth of American economy grew the girl culture, in which the flapper was the contested and celebrated emblem. Oh, and Anita Loose, who saw herself as a great pioneer of flapper fashion, said, described the flapper, "Full of corn liquor, stockings rolled down, skirts cut short, hair windblown, she was in every way in harmony with the spirit of the times." So the flapper was supremely visible, and the novelty of her appearance could simplify, provide an emblem for what was actually a complex and contested social changes that were taking place at the time. And this emphasis on youth echoed not only America's own youth, the newest nation in the world, and the new economic powerhouse, but also seemed to represent a utopian belief that a new modern world could sweep away the trappings of the old world, epitomized by the disasters of the First World War in Europe, and also, in a certain extent, the old-fashioned class structures and so on. So if the flapper films illustrate the way that Hollywood adapted these discourses of sexuality that articulated the changing climate of America as a whole, young women were achieving new levels of social and sexual liberation that found some reflection on the screen. Now, although for feminist theory, the flapper films offer a glimpse into a regime of cinematic desire in which the supremacy of the male protagonist is displaced, but this discourse of desiring sexuality was also marked by contradictions. Always there was the threat of censorship. It was before the days of the Legion of Decency, but the fear of censorship imposed from outside always brought the movies back to endings which would be constructed by convention, so that the exhilaration of image, performance, and event would be negotiated back into some kind of conformity. The flapper iconography in itself also bore, to my mind, and this is more intuitive than actually researched, but it seems to me to be a necessary way of thinking about it, bore a weight of conformity by projecting a homogeneously white image of the very racially divided population of the United States. So the success of the young modern woman as a sign of liberated sexuality, the new discourses articulated around her image, was achieved through repressions that supported social and economic equalities, and perhaps the kind of repression of the presence of the factory and the presence of the mass working class might be one aspect of this. But the very visibility of the young modern woman also draws attention to the equivalent obscurity of her black equivalent, who was also moving north, coming to the cities in search of new economic opportunities and new social freedoms. And it seemed to me that this kind of absence was particularly apparent on the Hollywood screen, as during the 1920s, black performers were beginning to arrive in mainstream entertainment through Broadway and the record industry, but failed to find any recognition, space, or place on the Hollywood screen. So, I mean, one might perhaps suggest that the radical promise of sexual freedom provided an acceptable discourse of freedom in a country that was still apartheid in a way that was reflected very clearly on its dominant, on the screens of its dominant film industry. Now, at the same time, America could be seen from abroad as what I think of, perhaps it's a rather trite phrase, but to me it's evocative, as the democracy of glamour. And it could successfully project this image of equality into a desire for America and its goods that could then be translated in very varying national instances into a real challenge to entrenched class and patriarchal traditions. So just to sum up here, the image of the modern American girl might be divided into three component parts. One, quite directly, simply, she represents, is derived from the economic conditions that produced her and the urban consumer-orientated culture of American modernity. Secondly, looking outwards, she represents the novelty of America as democratic and glamorous to the rest of the world as it emerged as a dominant power, definitively replacing replacing the British Empire in the period after the First World War. But then the emblematic status of this femininity, youth, innocent sexuality could paper over the deep divisions of class and race that actually haunted American society. So while the young modern woman celebrated American modernity and its successful penetration of world markets, she possibly helped to American society to avoid its actual internal contradictions. And this wasn't only a period that was very important for race struggle, but it was, of course, the period of Sacco and Vanzetti, union struggles and so on, none of which perhaps, I mean, it might be naive of me even to think about it, but aren't necessarily reflected in on the screen. So so I'm arguing that the sexiness of American films played a key role in establishing American exports as desirable in world markets. And in this process, I think as it's being researched more and more thoroughly, Hollywood consciously cooperated with the American government's export drive, and the cinema became quite literally a shop window for American goods of all kinds. But once again, these economic and ideological issues cut both ways, creating what one could think of as the problem of America, as America offers abroad an image of liberation and a model of modernity on the one hand, and domination and economic mastery on the other. And so on the same lines as the US economy in general, Hollywood profited from the devastation left by the First World War in Europe, entered competitively into the world market, spreading what I've been referring to as the image of the democracy of glamour. So at the same time, in the term coined by Soviet director Lev Kuleshov, Americanitis, which he used to describe the widespread fascination with America, its modernity, and its cinema, you know, in the Soviet Union, as he was witnessing it at the time, so even in the Soviet Union. So Americanitis, in some ways, can't be reduced simply to economic domination. Hollywood cinema as an aesthetic and an industry stands in between culture and economics, reflecting on social conditions outside itself, while also giving image and narrative to contradictions and difficulties that cannot find easy resolution. So although the United States didn't invent the relationship between femininity and consumer culture, again, we could go back to Zola and Au Bonheur des Femmes, it was there that the democracy of glamour came into being, streamlined and politicized. Feminist historian Sally Alexander has given an account of the impact of Hollywood on young women growing up in London in the 1920s. And this is a piece of proper systematic research, oral history, and research back into the condition of young women in London in the 1920s. She says, the cheap trappings of glamour were seized on by many young women in the 1920s, yearning to escape the domestic treadmill of their mothers' lives, haunted by the fantasy, not of the prostitute of the 19th century, but of the glamorous screen heroines, who paradoxically could be you, the girl next door. Wanting to lead different lives from their mothers had, enormous influence came from the cinema. Court dressmakers continued to turn out stiffened brocade and satins, but high fashion failed to capture the imagination of the young. Mimetic images of Harlow, Garbo, Crawford paraded the high street as they glowed on the cinema screen. In this way, the mantle of glamour passed from the aristocrat and the courtesan to the shop, office, or factory girl via the film star. And I want to show you a little clip. It's of a film called Hindlewakes, made by Maurice Elvey in 1928. And it's actually set in a kind of mythical, a kind of equivalent of Manchester in the cotton industry. And we see the girls, we see the whistle blowing to tell the factory that it's Wakes Week. Wakes Week was the one week of holiday when the factory closed down completely and everybody went to Blackpool. Blackpool, for those of you who don't know, probably, I'm sorry to be so parochial about this, is like Coney Island. So I just want to show this sequence of the transition from working girl to modern girl. That's it. There's more and more work being done recently, as I said at the beginning of this paper, about the way in which the aspiration to modernity was spreading across the world. The large urban conglomerates. Liu Ufanli describes in Shanghai the close connection between movies, modernity, and femininity. It became increasingly common practice to feature news and photos about movies and movie stars in the mushrooming journals for women. In this newly constructed modern lady image and lifestyle, an interest in movies was definitely de rigueur. In Rio, Cairo, film industries were developing with women playing an important part as stars, but also in production. Carmen Santos was influential in Rio in the early 30s. Aziza Amir was one of a number of women key to the formation of the Egyptian film industry in the late 20s and 30s. Now, I just want to move on to another phase of my paper, if it goes on too long, I'll cut it. This is more about questions of kind of cinema aesthetics and the aesthetics, what we might call kind of the sensibility associated with a young modern woman. Now, Miriam Hansen has used the term vernacular to evoke the ordinary culture of modernity rather than the high culture of modernism, but also to extend questions of this culture into questions of translatability. So she says, I'm referring to this kind of modernism as vernacular because the term combines the dimension of the quotidian, the everyday life, with connotations of discourse, idiom, dialect, with circulation, promiscuity, and translatability. In this sense, I address the vexed question of Americanism, the question of how and why an aesthetic idiom developed in one country that could achieve transnational and global currency. And so the idea of the vernacular of everyday life translates into the vernacular of the screen. And she argues that the cinema had a particularly reflexive relationship to modernity, and particularly in its representation of the material presence of the quotidian. In a sense, we can see that in Menschen am Sonntag, the details of everyday life are, I think, what makes the texture of that movie still stay very much alive. And she says, by forging a mass market out of an ethnically and culturally heterogeneous society, often at the expense of racial others, American cinema developed an idiom that traveled more easily than its national popular rivals. Whether we like it or not, American movies offered something like the first global vernacular. It was not just what these films showed, not just what they brought into optical consciousness, as it were, but the way they opened up hitherto unperceived modes of sensory perception and experience, their ability to suggest a different organization of the daily world. And recently, many film historians have drawn attention to the way that cinema reflects, I mean, Miriam Hansen, but a lot of others as well, the pace and spectacle of modernity's mobility and ephemerality. So the flapper films, in the flapper films, the aesthetic of mobility and the ephemeral reflects another central strand of modern culture, the body as site of display and of pleasure. If the awareness of cinema itself, particularly of camera movement, charged the modernity of cinema, it was the physical presence of the movie moderns that charged the flapper genre in particular. In the first instance, the cinema simply caught the various fashions, lifestyle revolutions that were taking place in society at large, so simply, as it were, imaged them, represented them. And as we all know, this reinvention of the female body began with a rejection of the past. 20s fashion came to celebrate movement, youth, and it resonated then with the cinema's own attributes, its speed and its investment in the passing moment. So with short hair and short skirts, the streamlined, healthy body pioneered by the dancer Irene Castle, was popularized by the flapper fashions. And in The Great Gatsby, Scott Fitzgerald mentions Jordan Baker, the young tennis player's body, as tanned, blithe, and androgynous. And this, of course, was the period of nightlife dance crazies. And in Love 'em and Leave 'em, Louise Brooks' Janie can Charleston until dawn and go to work in the department store the next morning. It was essential to be fit. Laurie Landy, in an article on the flapper film, makes this point. She introduces the concept kinesthetics, The modern embodied subjectivity expressed by and experienced in the lived body of both flapper actresses and flapper spectators twirled, sauntered, clowned, slid, flew, and of course danced its way into a new aesthetic. To use Hill Schwartz's evocative term, a new keen aesthetic. So the flapper stars, Colleen Moore, Joan Crawford, Gloria Swanson, Louise Brooks, and especially, I think, Clara Bow, personify a kind of chain of linked connotations or resonances. So first, the cinema's self-consciousness of its own movement of being the movies found an affinity, a metonymy, as it were, with the speed of the modern city when the camera travelled on cars, trams, trains to exaggerate its speed and picked up on the rapidly changing images of the city streets as an extension of its own powers of montage, splicing together rapidly changing images from, say, you know, advertisement to advertisement or as an obvious example. But then the young modern woman's body image, adapted as it was to an ease of movement, particularly expressed in the energy of contemporary fashion and dance that I just mentioned, fused with the cinema and found once again a linked... Fused with the cinema and once again linked metonymically to the movement of her urban setting. So the speed of modern city life merges with the energy of the modern urban American girl, and both are translated onto the screen through the movement of film itself that then captures and celebrates the relentless energy of the stars, the urban settings in which they live and work. Furthermore, flapper fashion brought an element of performance with it. Modernity was a stance and a performance, enhancing the close relation between femininity as a construction and the performance of that construction. And the flapper stars performed the performance. And now I'm just going to show a short sequence of Clara again. This first image that we'll see is of Mr. Waltham's very old-fashioned but extremely rich girlfriend. And as you will see, the way in which this is shot, and she's introduced from quite far away. And anyway, if we run it, we'll see how the sequence evolves. Girlfriend flatmate is helping her to get ready for the evening. Now you'll see her desiring look again. So these kinds of metonymies of movement, as I think of it, lead to a more abstract, more metaphorical, perhaps, sense of life itself caught in the process of change. That is, as different mobilities condense on the screen, they not only capture the upheavals of modernity, but also the ephemerality of the modern moment. And to my mind, this is epitomized by the chance romantic encounter, which is enabled by urban modern life. So the contiguity of the modern body and the urban space then links into the space of the story and then introduces another dimension, that of desire. So the movement of desire as movement. The cinema brings together the movement of its images and the shifting patterns of the urban landscape. And then, selecting its emblematic characters, it weaves these tropes of modernity into romantic encounters. The representation of desire as movement is central to their visual realization, whether the chance encounters in the street or elongated in sequence of funfair rides. Because, again, one of the kind of recurring scenes, you know, moments in these movies is the funfair ride. And I don't think I've got time to show the one from Hindlewakes. We'll see. So these two figures of movement, metonymy and metaphor, then pivot around the image of the young modern woman who enables the shift from one plane, that of the city and the energy of the cinema, to the other, the movement of desire. So now I'm going to show you the example from Menschen am Sonntag that we've just seen. And it's the very famous sequence of the pickup at the beginning when this casual romantic encounter brings all the elements of mobility together, and particularly the way that it's filmed, seemingly, I don't know if this is the case or not, seemingly with concealed cameras so that it can actually capture the movement of the people in the street without inhibition, but also the way that the movements of the trams, the trains, the buses, the people all seem to kind of bring, seem to materialize the movement of the city into the movement of desire. Can we? Window of the bus, do you see, or the tram, or whatever it is? And now my next one, which Aaron is almost immediate, I'm afraid, this time. It's taken from Mario Camerini's film *Gli uomini che mascalzoni*, which I'll ask Nicola. Yes, the men, what rascals they are. Is that the right translation?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's made in 1932. It's a very, very early sound period. And actually we see a very young Vittorio De Sica in his first ever film appearance. He's the young man. Goodness, I can't remember the name of the actress who plays Marietta. It speaks for the sequence will speak for itself. Again, it's the same way in which the movement of the city transport, and the pickup relationship between the two. It should be the next one, the very next one. Yes, Mariella. Yes. Thank you. soundtrack. So those two examples seem to me to show that kind of interweaving between the modern city, the style of the young woman, and she's reading her Young Modern Woman journal, Piccola, and this movement of desire, which kind of generates the kind of urban pickup. In this context, I wanted just, ending in 2 minutes, to just a quote from Giuliana Bruno's book, The Atlas of Emotion, which I think is, she makes a point that's very relevant to the two little extracts that I've just shown. She says, "I'll set forth as a major premise of the Atlas that motion, indeed, produces emotion, and that correlatively, emotion contains movement. Cinema was named after the Greek word kinema, which connotes both motion and emotion. My view of film as a means of transport thus understands transport in the full range of its meaning, including the sort of carrying away, which is the carrying away by emotion, as in transports of joy, or in trasporto, which in Italian encompasses the attraction of human beings to one another. It implies more than the movement of bodies and objects imprinted in the change of film frames and shots, the flow of camera movement, or any other shift in point of view. Cinematic space not only moves through time and space of narrative development, but through inner space. So the cinema is also characterized by its geographical mobility, and transport and translation can then be harnessed into the literal mobility of the cinema as a medium that could carry the aspirations of modernity, its motion, and its emotion around the world." Now, as we all know, the decade ended with the 1929 crash and the subsequent economic depression that brought the flapper era to an end. Her emblematic status had been closely tied to the economic conditions of the 1920s, expansion of employment to include young women, the credit-led consumer boom. And if the 1920s produced an idiom of vernacular modernism out of a period of boom, the decade hints that the conditions in which girl culture flourish are closely connected to expanding economy and consumption. And the close connection between the economic boom and its contemporary popular culture is confirmed by the shifts of ideology around the crash. The frivolous culture of the flapper went immediately into decline. The economic depression that overwhelmed the United States in 1929 brought an end to the flapper era with its resonances of irresponsibility, indulgence, and also reversed the advances in women's employment during the crash, during the years of expansion. The crash and the depression hit the United States only a year after a change of enormous importance overtook Hollywood. The major studios bowed to the inevitable and accepted the transition to synchronized sound. I think it's worth pointing out here that the arrival of sound might have been a possible moment for the new generation of black performers who'd been working on, as you were pointing out the other day, in Shuffle Along, Blackbirds, and so on. Sound could have opened up opportunities for those artists, but in fact, almost on the contrary, it completely excluded them, kind of confirming the fact that even when its economic interests were perhaps at stake, Hollywood couldn't kind of compromise with its near-apartheid situation, commitment, or whatever. But so the period that I've been trying to evoke, in one sense, offers a straightforward example of the determining force of the economic, the flapper phenomenon arising out of it. But at the same time, how and through what imagery popular culture would negotiate and celebrate the young modern woman was never certain or secure. And in a sense, what I'm trying to do there, though I might have been too timid to write it down, was to try and put a kind of Freudian understanding of the period on top of a Marxist understanding of the period, so that, as it were, the signifier young modern woman in the discourse of sexuality, as it were, demands a sense of psychoanalytic theory, while at the same time one can't avoid the economic conditions that brought the phenomenon to the fore. That's all. I didn't go. Oh, we've got one more. Shall we do the last one?
Okay. Yeah.
The last one, it's again, it's an Italian film. It's called La Segretaria Privata. And it's a sequence just where a young woman has gone into the big city. I'm not sure which city it is. I don't think we actually see it. I think it's more or less shot on the studio. And she's determined to get a job as a private secretary, as a segretaria privata. And this little sequence shows her reaction when she hears the news that she's got a job. And so it ends in the office where she hears the news. It begins in the office where she hears the news. It ends in the girl's hostel where she's staying. It's not a musical, I hasten to say. And then we see them all going to work. Okay, that's one. So I love that sequence because of the ebullience of having just got a job as a private secretary. And it seems to me to summarise some of those kind of perhaps rather naive seeming aspirations of the young modern woman. Right. Well, I've gone on. I haven't gone on too long, but I've gone on quite long, so I don't know if people want to have some discussion or whether we should just stop.
Maybe we'll take a couple of questions, and if people
want to. Right.
I'd love to ask a question, but I hope it's not a distracting question. The first thing I wanted to notice with regard to Wilder and Slotnick writing the script, they would also have thought of the fact that trakeer, which is traffic, has a very sexual connotation.
Oh, I see. Well, it's so obvious in the way that the sequence is edited together, but I think it comes across. What is it in German?
It can be like sexual intercourse.
Yes.
Which leads to here.
Right. Yes.
It's traffic.
Yes.
Right. But that's
yes.
A little cycle.
Yeah.
What I wanted to ask was, I understand that between the Flapper films that you showed and, say, The Blue Angel, the Depression intervenes. But against the sort of contrast that you've now built for me, in connecting tempo and movement and desire and modernity and so on, the slowness and deliberateness of Dietrich's motion
is quite different.
Really striking.
Yeah.
Now. I wonder if you have, from this perspective, whether you
can
reflect again on Dietrich.
Well, I mean, it's to a certain extent the way that, I mean, that very deliberate performance is characteristic of Sternberg's direction, whether it's in the silent period or in the talky period. And, I mean, in a sense, I'm drawing attention perhaps to a rather minor collection of films, not art films. I mean, because I think one of the things that's important to realise about Hollywood at the time was that films like What am I trying to think of? Well, like the crowd, King Vidor, Murnau, Sternberg, could travel. I mean, Hollywood was not relegated to the non-art at that time. And so I think there's a way in which Sternberg always had a very deliberate kind of direction, which you don't see in these movies. They're much more work a day. Also, he liked that very, very deliberate performance. But there's also the coming of sound and the way in which, although the camera could still travel if there was no synchronized sound needed, whenever you had to have actual synchronized sound, people had to be very, very, very carefully controlled. I mean, we can all remember Singing in the Rain, just talk into the mic, you know. So there was the way in which the cinema was in its dialogue, was very much grounded in this period. But I also think that Dietrich had this kind of associations of femme fatale-ism, which is very unlike the young modern woman that I've been drawing attention to. I mean, so Garbo, a kind of great star in this period, doesn't have that kind of energy that I've been evoking. Yes.
There's a kind of iconography of the young American girl already in art as early as Picabia's Young American Girl in a State of Nudity.
Yes.
A spark plug.
Yes, of course.
Spark plug.
Mm.
And Picasso's Young American Girl in Stage Sets for Corot.
Yes.
So
yes.
I'm just interested to know, you know, how far back one could take it and whether these films might have picked up on any of those. Or I think it must have been already circulating.
I mean, following Miriam Hansen, who's really my kind of authority on this, I mean, the way that she argues it is that the expansion of women as an actual force at the box office enabled these movies to come to have a presence as a genre. But I think, you know, the fascination with America was in a sense so closely associated with the modern that, you know, on the side of the avant-garde modernity, it would always have been there, whereas the kind of popular modernism that I think these movies come out of, is possible, especially in Hollywood, is very much of the 1920s. But I don't know about, I mean, if one looked at stories and advertising and so on, well, I'm sure that there'd be different kinds of a zigzag of developments. And then there were so many other things happening. I mean, some of these movies, I mean, discuss, you know, birth control and abortion. Our Modern Maidens, which is a great Joan Crawford movie set in an upper-class milieu, there's a kind of abortion crisis in it, which is quite daring for an MGM movie. So there was a way in which the movies were trying to echo some of the actual debates that were going on. What I haven't done is make kind of proper connections between the actual debates in newspapers, magazines, and so on. But is there someone there?
Yes. So I was so excited to hear you address a specifically female audience. We're talking about the Flapper film tonight. But I'm wondering what happens in the exchange of desire and of looks when a woman looks at a film that's been structured specifically for the male desire, and when a male looks at a film that's been structured so specifically for...
Yes. My line on that, pretty unfashionable nowadays, is that it's kind of textually governed. So that, for instance, when we see Betty Lou, Clara Bow, look at Mr. Waltham, we actually, you know, follow her look. So in the audience, it doesn't matter what gender we are. That's the position that we're put in. And, you know, the equivalent, the opposite is much more usual, and it's what we're much more familiar with. So, but lots of people have argued against that, you know, with considerable justice. And so, in a sense, here I was trying to kind of balance text, context. And nowadays, you know, that kind of textual approach is really rather unfashionable. And the kind of thinking of audiences in their specificities and audience members in their specificities has made quite an important kind of correction to one side.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what is the attitude of the director who was making the film on Sunday toward the young American girl, the way it's represented? Simply because we don't only see her in the urban setting, but also in nature, and then we'll also see her, you know, having intercourse with this man, and right after the intercourse, she appears to wear lipstick. So this notion, and then the camera pans onto the natural scene that's defiled by, you know, by previous presence. So, and then, I mean, I'm just wondering, what is it, celebration of artificiality, or is it critique of artificiality that's sort of that young American?
I don't know. Perhaps other people could help me with this. But, I mean, I would have thought that their interest would be much more with actually trying to kind of capture something of the times and the paradoxes of the young women's ability to express desire, but the way that their rather loutish young men still seem to belong to another world, you know. And it's probably very much the case at the end that they're going to go to the football match the following Sunday rather than go out with the girls again. But, I mean, I think the point about nature is that it isn't nature. I mean, this is the... what was the name of the lake? The
Nicholas.
Nicholas, yes. Which is an urban... I mean, it's as though you went to the... what's the name of the big park in Philadelphia? Yeah, it's more like that, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it's very, very urban. And so I think what you see repeatedly when you move away from our main characters is you see the urban mass of Berlin, you know, enjoying a Sunday out. So it's not very natural. And there's something very kind of poignant, perhaps ironic, perhaps mischievous, perhaps unkind, in that pan across the trees, because if you notice, we end up with some kind of detritus of the city, and then the camera comes all the way the way back. But I think it's important to emphasize it's the rural within the urban. It'd be the same as if you went down to the Delaware River. Is it the Delaware River?
Yeah.
Would?
We've got two rivers.
Yes, both of us. Yes.
I like maybe we should stop in and have informal conversations. But thank you.